All right, so we've talked a lot about the kind of the foundation. How do we view the earth? How do we view man and his role? And so we're kind of going to get into two of some of the main topics, I guess, around page 7. And leading up to page 7, on page 6 and the top of 7, there's just kind of some general observations that we might make kind of based on our study. So maybe we could kind of run through those and contrast them with maybe an unbiblical view, okay, when we think about the environment. So like when you look at man as made in the image of God, we begin a responsibility to rule the world and exercise dominion over the animal kingdom. It's not for our own gratification, but for God's glorification. And how we rule will help us to draw closer to God. So what's maybe a couple competing or alternate views when you think about how to view mankind that's maybe more common?
Well, the human is an animal, yeah, like all the other mammals. Mm-hmm. And there's really no great distinction between the two.
Mm-hmm.
Other, yeah, than one's more powerful than the other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So that's a common, just the product of chance and time, kind of the Darwinian.
Eating another animal is like murder.
What's that?
Eating another animal is murder.
Right. You're just one animal, they're just another animal. What about, so that kind of ties into number two as well, that we're distinct from the animal kingdom. Number three, mankind is good for creation in that we cultivate it and keep it. We're going to talk about how maybe there's some competing views with that. So what's maybe some differing views with that man is good for the earth because we cultivate it? This is what I do in class. Someone other than Pastor Hintz, right? In class, sometimes I'll have
Marshall.
You got to encourage the class participation.
That's right.
You're right.
We're
trying to help. We're trying to help each other. Sometimes it's like, what do you think?
Dr. Marshall.
Oh, Pastor Hint.
Pastor Hint and Dr. Marshall.
We're being super formal today.
Help loosen up the class. We can do it that way.
We forgot the question.
Yeah, what was your question?
I don't remember. Something very formal. I think I was just trying to say that we talked about how a biblical view is that man is good for creation, that we're called to cultivate it, to keep it, to bring about good and order. So what is that in the environmental world and in this discussion, what is maybe the competing views that we'll have of mankind? Or maybe contrary views to that?
And the main competing view is that we humans are doing nothing good for the earth. We are just tearing it apart, and everything would be better off if we would just leave it alone.
Yeah, I'd say that's an alternate view.
Yeah.
I think that's very different. Yeah.
Yeah, very different.
Right. We're ruining it. We're ruining this ocean and ruining everything.
The rainforests and everything is.
Right. And that's going to kind of relate to the first kind of main topics that we'll talk about is population control. So let's kind of flip over there. So if you look on page 7, when you think about population control, right, why do we want to control, or why would someone argue for the control of human population? And what Lauren said is a lot really kind of helps understand why, right? And two main concerns you can see there is that the needs and wants of people are, one, using up, right, using up the earth's resources, and two, that they're polluting the earth, right, so that it can no longer sustain life. It's threatening, it's catastrophic, and you'll see there, kind of second to last, humankind is principally a consumer and a polluter, and these two traits can be summed up in a single trait, that humankind is fundamentally destructive, okay?
So are you saying that maybe we should have some semi-divine being with superpowers do what he can to cut the universe's population in half to save the rest?
need some rings for that.
Gonna do what?
Need some stones.
Need some rings.
Need some stones. Need some stones. Yeah. That's right. That's right. The he's referencing the Thanos, right? Right. The death. That means death.
Yes.
It's good that we all know the references, but yeah, that's the idea. The idea of Thanos is that kill off a lot of the population because there's just not enough resources for everyone, and it will bring balance, mm-hmm. right? It brings balance to the universe. So Dave is characterizing the main environmental view as Thanos' view in the Avengers.
It seems we have, I think we've talked about this swinging pendulum, because humans can be extremely destructive. In early days of this country, I mean, they're wiping out mm-hmm. species and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But then we swing back the other way to where now we're at. That's the only thing we're capable of.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to limit our population.
Yeah. And I think we talked about that at the beginning a little bit, and that like there's these two kind of polar opposite mm-hmm. ends of the spectrum. And we want, it seems like when we get to one end, like that's bad, so we would go the other the other polar extreme. And I think that it's true that we don't want to negate the fact that those evil, abusive, pollutive, right, there are many tendencies that we have to consume and pollute and destroy. It's possible. Yeah. And I think that we see that the more sinful and depraved we are, the more we kind of continue into those thoughts and patterns and actions. And so not only does creation need redeemed, but mankind and its purpose needs to be redeemed, right? So, okay. So we're consumers. Let's look at, we can view ourselves as consumers. We can also flip over to page 8. I think trying to shift our view from being a consumer instead to being someone or a people that's going to make the earth better or make it as good as it can be, in a sense. And I think that when we read here in the second one, we talked about people can be productive, they could be creative, they can bring order out of chaos, making more resources than we consume, right? So that's kind of a key thing. So I forgot to bring the stats, but there was a time where in the last century, it would say, you know, how many people one farmer would feed, you know, like in the 1900s, 1920s. And that number has continued to grow. And so when you look at that perspective, you can see how, in that case, man is not principally just a consumer, but he's also a producer. He's providing for other people and not other animals, livestock. We talked about that. I thought this was an interesting quote here. If you want to look. So, back in 200, right? I didn't look up what the population was in 200 on the planet. It's smaller than today. So, back in 200, everything has been visited, everything known, everything exploited. Now, pleasant estates obliterate the famous wilderness areas of the past. Plowed fields have replaced forests. Domesticated animals have dispersed wildlife. Beaches are plowed, mountains smoothed, and swamps drained. There are as many cities as in former years there were dwellings. Islands do not frighten, nor cliffs deter. Everywhere there are buildings, everywhere people, everywhere communities, everywhere life. Proof of this crowding is the density of human beings we weigh upon the world, and its resources hardly suffice to support us. As our needs grow larger, so do our protests that already nature does not sustain us. In truth, plague, famine, wars, and earthquakes must be regarded as a blessing to civilization, since they prune away the luxuriant growth of the human race.
Dun, dun,
dun, dun, dun. The optimistic view.
Who quoted that?
This is Tertullian, a church father. He was alarmed.
Yeah, the world population at that time was probably about 300 million.
It's grown a little bit since then. 20 times more.
This is an argument they're still saying.
Yep. Right, right. Yeah. So, one of the things to think about is, again, you know, as kind of what we talked about with agriculture and cultivation is, as humans, you know, begin to grow in the population, they do consume more. And so, how have we compensated for that? We just grow more. Yeah, we produce more. And so, viewing mankind as, if we were growing a population and that population was not contributing anything back into the earth, then that this would make sense that they're going to consume the limited amount of resources that 300 million people were using. But if they become contributors, then as the population grows, the resources are going to...
Yeah, I remember when I was in college, I took a macroeconomics class, and there's this formula to assess the estimated gross national product and, you know, the prosperity of a country. And one of the positive indicators was human population. And that was just kind of contrary to everything I kind of understood up until that point, where I thought the more people, it's kind of like you have this fixed pie, and the more people you have, the smaller the pieces. As opposed to seeing humans as somebody who can actually expand the pie. And yeah, everyone, you know, there's more pieces to go around, but if it's a bigger pie, everybody gets more.
Right.
And part of the reason is, you know, humans humans are resources. They tend to create more than they take. And they're healthy and prosperous.
Yeah. She agrees?
I think there's also the concept of, if we didn't have to learn how to do things differently, if we didn't have to learn how to produce wheat and soybeans and corn on a mass level, we probably never would have. Because we wouldn't have been forced to do that to support, you
Very
know,
true.
And make, you know, a lot of time for money. But if we had stayed at 300 million people, everyone probably would have just lived in their own little farming land, which would have been fine, but there was an essence of, because we grew so largely, there had to be a way to support that population. Yeah. And so people came up with combines and all other sorts of machinery in order to do big productions.
Yeah, and I think in one sense you could take kind of we're comparing the alternate view that man is just another animal, or sometimes that man is the worst animal that's destroying it for everyone else. You could kind of compare it with that view of, look at what man has done to improve the earth, and compare that to what has any of the other animals.
Chimpanzees have.
It really added a lot to the production of food supply, right? So man has done more, right? Yeah, so much more.
God created us, man, with an appetite for knowledge. So I don't think they would have just stayed the same anyway, because they have a desire for knowledge to do better.
Yeah, and I think that there is something to, I think sometimes when we talked at the beginning about, we have to be careful when we compare the pre-fall account of man, right, to how we should interact with the environment today. Because like Joe brought up, right, man ideally, we know what his goal and his purpose and his role should be, but we do need to know like how to deal, it brings the gospel back in, how do we deal with the fact that we are at times destructive, and we are at times polluting and dumping nuclear waste out in different places.
Well, I've been reading Elizabeth Elliot's Through the Gates of Splendor, and they talk about how the original Shell oil company that went down in the those places, they were terrible to the native people and the native area. I mean, they just didn't have a view of maintaining it in a good way, and they just destroyed things, and they didn't foster good relationships, and so definitely think there's a balance of called to cultivate, but we're also called, you know, you have to do it in a way that's glorifying the Lord and not just coming in and killing a bunch of people and
I think, you know, humans, one of the rules of human diplomacy and even capitalism is humans operate their own self-best interest. And so I think we've kind of learned that if you just raise all these forests, in future generations, there won't be enough to sustain what we need to do in the future. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, part of human ingenuity is just understanding, you know, long-term gains versus mm-hmm. short-term ones. And they've kind of made some, like, yeah. you don't want to make the natives upset because they might spear your construction workers.
Right, right. And a lot of times it's forced. It's not because that's one of the things. Sometimes we don't have the foresight to say, well, this looks like it would be better, but we're still, things are still working okay for now. And we get to the point where, okay, that's not working anymore. And then I think that with the, we've just talked about how businesses have made many changes to infrastructure and things like that with COVID and kind of their internet presence and all the things that maybe they should have done a year ago or 5 years ago, but now they have to do that. And so maybe, you know, as things progress and kind of return to more normal business, they will have a lot of things in place that they wouldn't have had. Okay, let's look at some other kind of statistical ideas. One thing is, make a note here, this top of page 9. Well, on page 8, the biblical view of humans and the universe predicts that as we apply our minds to raw materials, scarcity of resources will decline. So in other words, the supply of resources will increase relative to the demand for them, as we were talking about. So falling labor capital costs of resource production and falling inflation-adjusted resource prices is precisely what we find when we look at history. So when you think about what it cost to acquire the food that we have today versus 100 years ago, 500 years ago, right? Relative, it's very easy for a person to go get a loaf of bread or to go get, you know, whatever they need. And the cost is relatively low when you kind of adjust for the inflation. Okay. Statistics that show that we're making it better. Well, so we'll talk about extinction first, right? Are we worried about chickens going extinct? Why not?
6 billion.
6 billion? Yeah.
Keep growing more chickens.
Have to do what?
Said we can keep growing more chickens.
Keep growing more chickens, right? So kind of it's interesting to look not only at the agricultural and crops, but also the animal, right? The animal population. And it just seems, and not being, like kind of being an outsider looking in, it's just interesting to see times in history where there are times where people have been, we've had economic depression, but a lot, oftentimes it's we've had an overproduction of, in a sense, like we've overproduced, and there's been such a production that the value has dropped so tremendously. And so oftentimes it's not, when we're reaching those points, it's not that there is no food, it's just that there's the economic depression is kind of coming because there's an overabundance and there's no value brought to that. So kind of an interesting, different, you'd think, oh, for just like I've been reading through the famine, right, in when Joseph was in Egypt, right, and they had the 7 good years, they stored up all the crops, and then 7 years was just, there wasn't anything. And say, kind of the same thing, he says that God brought me here and brought this about so that many people would be saved. So through the wisdom of storing up the crops and putting the grain away, they dealt with the famine in a way that many people would have just been totally wiped out. If you go 7 years without being able to produce food, yeah, it's going to be pretty rough.
Yeah, and it's interesting. A lot of times, because there's more population and there's more consumers, that means there's more demand, which makes it profitable and incentivizes increasing the supply. And so sometimes increasing population actually increases technology and human ingenuity and necessity to do all those things. That's why food is, even though we have so many more consumers now than before, and there's so much more demand, there's even more supply to the point that the prices are sinking. And so, I mean, it's amazing. You go to Walmart and just get whatever you want from all over the world.
Yeah.
It is unbelievable when you really think about it.
Yeah. It's crazy.
I mean, cheap food is just an accepted reality.
Larger populations, less starvation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean,
it's true.
Say what you will about GMOs. I mean, it makes us pick a lot of food.
Yeah, and one thing I've noticed just talking with a few people from some of the other parts of the world is that, like, for example, when our friends from Brazil were here, we'd ask them, you know, what's it like? You have the same things available in the stores, and he would say, you can get all the same things, but there it's like there's four choices, and here it's like there's 50 choices of pop or chips or whatever. Mm-hmm. Or, like in Kazakhstan, during those times, it was like big grocery stores, tons of stuff. It's just, but there would be like local things that, or some things were just unique. Peanut butter was rare in a lot of different parts where it's just, that's just, if they wanted it, if there was demand, there'd be a ton of peanut butter. Right?
Well, the stuff that is, like peanut butter is really expensive in other places.
Mm-hmm.
But in the United States, it's real. I mean, you can buy cheap peanut butter, you can buy really expensive peanut butter, you can buy any type of range of peanut butter that you want, but in other countries, it's like, you're going to pay
right.
a lot for the cheap.
Yeah.
You know, in the United States, it costs $1.50, but in a different country, it's going to cost you $12.
Yeah.
Because, and you only have one option of peanut butter. You don't get the 50 options of peanut butter, you only get one.
Right. Right. Okay, so let's flip over and talk about some questions. So what are some things when you think about population control? Right, these are questions that you have to think about. So, right, number one, we are still many nations, right? There's lots of people groups all over the planet. And so let's say we here in Kansas, or we in the United States, right? There's still a huge variety. So if... we're thinking, like, which population are we going to control? Can one country tell another, okay, you're growing too fast. We're doing okay, but, right? It doesn't make any sense.
Airdrop birth control, you know, over India, right?
Yeah. Yeah. But on the flip side, there is a Christian place to criticize and speak to the moral issue of when countries are exercising population control, if it's kind of a mandated government, like there's abuses in China where there's some kind of forced kind of population control, even like sterilization, things like that with certain minority people groups. So there's kind of an ethical point there where if someone is doing that, someone is trying to mandate other groups and control their population or eliminate them, there's a place to speak. Birth control policies often advocate abortion here because they often view just people as a burden instead of a blessing. And number three, I think, is a key one. Emphasis on overpopulation detracts from the real problem, which is poverty. And there's a lot of issues related to that poverty. And when they think of overpopulation, they often show pictures of a really crowded place where people are poor instead of a really crowded place where people are very rich and affluent, right?
Yeah.
Both exist, and I think we talked about last time that we have enough food to feed everyone on the planet, but those who are hungry or poor, we have to look at what are the causes and how can we address those. It's good for the economy. It gives us more resources and consumers the more population we have. I think about long ago, it's like when, you know, each kid, as soon as they were able, right, they were helping out doing the chores. And the older they got, the more chores they got, the more work they could do. And you produced more as a family, more income, you were better off from your kids or contributing to the family. And I don't know, did you guys have experience with that? I know that teaching at school, I have a lot of families where the kids are working very early and they're kind of contributing to the... I don't know if anybody here has kids working. Yes?
Or if your kids work for somebody else.
Yeah. How early were your kids helping out with mowing and stuff?
From
Yeah.
As he's 7 now, but he was weed eating a lot when he was 6. Like.
And he still has all his fingers and toes.
I remember his age.
Isn't he not accomplished?
Yeah, they need just a lot of them.
Now, is it true that David was saying they don't get paid by the hour but by the job?
Yeah.
So they try and get out and get all the jobs done?
Yeah, they fight over it.
Yeah. Josiah has more money than me. Josiah.
He's a...
Wait till he goes to college.
Uh-oh.
Then all of a sudden you've got population shortage.
Uh-oh. You got to fill their...
Do yourself.
Oh, man, you really miss him. Right?
Yeah, the production went...
Oh, man.
Yeah,
it's so true.
All the help is gone, and now you're old and feeble and can't do it yourself. Can't afford to hire anybody. The slavery deal worked out really
well. Oh, my. Oh, my. You're going to have to guilt your back to come in. Part-time?
No, that don't work.
No work. No. Okay.
Well, years ago, I mean, when you only had to have 8th grade education,
mm-hmm.
you'd work... You go to school till 8th grade, and then you came home.
Oh yeah.
And worked on the farm.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, and there's a lot. Sometimes I try and explain to my kids that a lot of times, like a high school education, there's a lot that you're learning there that's very specific to train you for some complicated jobs and careers. And that they'll ask me, when am I going to use this? Like. When are you going to use anything you learn in any of your high school classes? It depends a lot on your future, you know. And kind of we've shifted to where high school education, it's more about preparing you to understand and view the world as a kind of a rounded citizen. You can have an understanding of some complex political issues, mathematical issues. You can understand complex grammar and writing so that when you read an article or research whatever, you can understand what they're saying. But people can go out, I tell them, I'm sure you could find a job and go out and live and exist, you know, without a lot of the stuff that I'm teaching you. So there is that truth that kind of like just surviving is kind of not really the educational goal anymore because there's lots of work. But a lot of those jobs as well are kind of continually progressing and morphing from, I used to be a cashier, and now I kind of work the machines that people self-check out. Right.
But the common sense of using your hands and learning how to work hard for something you want generally isn't taught anywhere but in situations of hard work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there's, you know, it's a, you know, mm-hmm. both sides.
That's true. That's true.
Yeah, I find it also interesting that population control, like you would think that a worldwide plague would be seen as a real benefit.
Right.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Like, right.
We've been watching, we've been waiting for the population to go down for a while so that we'll have more resources in the future. And it's fascinating to see how environmental concerns have really been set aside. Like, how much disposable stuff do we now use? Disposable masks, disposable wipes. All this stuff, because people, I think what it comes down to is we're fine regulating population control in India,
mm-hmm.
and we're fine regulating it in China and in all these other third world countries and kind of telling them that you need to do what we can so that we can live the way that we want to live.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when there's a certain almost hypocrisy and elitism to a lot of the environmental
mm-hmm.
movement.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
That does build resentment, and I think ultimately lead to class warfare.
Yeah, yeah, and that's, you know, we can kind of see that the more power and leadership we have, roles it feels like the more exempt we are from kind of practicing what we are
and why
preaching.
Do we fight disease? I mean, that's a question I'm always asking.
Mm-hmm.
Like, why the big push? Why for vaccines? And why for fighting against COVID? And why, you know.
Right.
An animal, and we're destroying the planet. Then
mm-hmm.
why are we
right.
clawing and striving to live longer and
true.
Longer?
Yeah, it's a good discussion too. You know, if you talk with someone who's a just very believes in that we've come out through, you know, evolution and survival of the fittest. Basically, we're operating as much as we can against that. We're trying to keep alive the least fit.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So why do you?
Yeah, the philosophy doesn't.
work.
It doesn't mesh, right? Right.
Yeah.
So. They can't live it out, what they think.
Yeah, it's not a coherent worldview.
And point five, causes for alarm negate the fact that the worldwide population has dropped from 2.2% in the 60s to 1.3% in 2000. Last night I looked, and I don't know if I can quote my source, but it was 1.1% in 2020 recently. Yeah. So that's still whatever. We got 7 billion, so 70 million people mm-hmm. a year. But
you know, it's also, I know I'm talking too much, but I have all these ideas.
Okay.
I mean, whenever there's like these post-apocalyptic movies, like Planet of the Apes,
right.
for instance, which is a great War for the Planet of the Apes. I really like that.
Lots of spiritual lessons there.
Spiritual lessons, but you notice, so you have these broken societies, and humans have been reduced to being hunter-gatherers and foragers. Mm-hmm. And so they don't make light bulbs anymore, but there's plenty of light bulbs and they kind of go out and find them. And what's interesting is with this radically reduced population, it coincides with worldwide impoverishment because it can't make electricity anymore. Mm-hmm. It can't manufacture things anymore.
All the interconnectedness.
Yeah, and so like this overpopulation, if people don't really get what they want, it leads to poverty. So mm-hmm. like you look at Japan, there's a major crisis in Japan because not enough people are having babies, and they have this older population that needs to be supported by younger people, and if there's not enough younger workers, mm-hmm. everybody is going to be impoverished.
Yeah.
So that's why like poverty is one of the major issues, and that seems to be forgotten in this kind of discussion.
Right. Yeah. Same thing whenever I see kind of those, the world has all died off, or there's one person left. I just ask, like, how long do you think, you know, if you were the only person and every other person on the planet vanished, how long do you think it would take for your water, your electricity, you know, television programming? Like, how much is automated, and how soon would things just, because you wonder, there's this infinite chain of interconnectedness. And somewhere there's someone that's doing something. You know, we kind of take for granted all the rules that people have, and mm-hmm. all of a sudden, there's no water, there's no gas, there's no electricity, there's, right? What happens when you remove people from the planet, how much you lose?
Mm-hmm. I mean, what are you going to fight all the zombies with?
I know. What did you talk about in Sunday school? Well, we know how to deal with zombies.
We went fishing last night, and we thought, well, we'll try to make a fire. Flint. And I mean, it wasn't long before you gave up because you just think about not having something to make fire with.
It's frustrating. Get the stick.
Most
and you
couldn't survive.
It's almost like it's a focus on the wrong problem, almost.
Yeah.
Because we have enough food. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have enough food to sustain the population of the earth. It's just, it's not being distributed correctly. So
yeah.
I just wonder if all the people that are big-wig people that are so focused on the overpopulation problem and trying to solve that problem,
mm-hmm.
if you guys would just take your energy and focus it on trying to fix poverty and distribute the food evenly, how quickly would that problem be solved?
Mm-hmm.
Because that's when I look at all of the people and all, you know, the big-wig people who are doing things for overpopulation or economy or what, you know, whatever the environment. I wonder, I'm like, if you actually put your head to the things that are legitimate problems that we
mm-hmm.
actually can do something about,
mm-hmm.
how quickly would those problems be solved versus
mm-hmm.
these other problems that necessarily aren't going to be solved in our lifetime
mm-hmm.
or couldn't be solved in our lifetime, but you could actually solve this problem.
Yeah.
It's just interesting. I think about that a lot.
Yeah.
How quickly could you actually solve poverty if you took the resources that you have, you know, even in the United States, with how much food waste we have and the things that restaurants throw away and all, you know, could you actually solve
right.
the problem?
Yeah.
Instead of, you know, creating
yep.
more problems that aren't actually problems.
Yeah.
It seems like on a national level, it seems like to me that in recent history, it's always been a leadership problem. You know, you take like the Ukraine, it was one of the most productive landscapes on the planet, but yet Stalin, people went through a famine because grain prices went up and Stalin needed to fill his coffers, so he sold, forced the grain to be sold mm-hmm. and not used.
Yeah.
And India, kind of the same thing. They're a huge producer of vegetables and things of that nature. Mm-hmm. It's all exported to fill the coffers of the government.
Mm-hmm.
And then, there was another one. I just forgot it. But it's a leadership issue.
Zimbabwe, maybe.
Probably, yeah. Yeah, I mean, everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, Africa's, should be one of the most prosperous continents on the planet. But, you go there and everybody's starving to death. No infrastructure, lots of resources, but lack of management, lack of people.
Right.
Going in the right direction.
Yeah.
So then the problem's not really poverty, but it's sin. It's mishandling the leadership.
Exactly.
Management. Mm-hmm. I mean,
there's a sense in which the greater the amount of sin individually and corporately, the more that works itself out in poverty and starvation and destruction. And so I think many times we don't realize, how long the blessing lasts for faithful people and faithful generations. And sometimes people feel like they don't realize we're in the judges cycle where things aren't prosperous now because of what we're doing. It's because of people that came before us. And so we may sometimes take actions that are going to lead to down the road, more destruction versus kind of like we talked about last time, leaving it better instead of just consuming it.
Yeah, you can unpack that deal. It take weeks.
Yeah.
The reasons and the possibilities of why this, why that. Mm-hmm. But there's some prime examples. Like farmers around where I live, everywhere else, kind of under a strain because of overproduction as far as having any money left over. And the middlemen, of course.
Right.
Getting their fair share.
Right.
But I'm not against capitalism or even naked capitalism. I probably misspoke last week. But as Christians, we should practice.
Yeah.
We're commanded to have restraints.
Mm-hmm.
Without naked capitalism, it would be hard for, when the government has to come in and start regulating everything.
Right.
You end up with Stalin.
Right. Yeah. And I think one of the key things, like scripturally, that kind of Jesus alludes to when you were preaching through the quotation about pastors deserve, being honored, is that the labor is worthy of their wages. And so in those cases, a lot of times the people that are laboring, when it's state or government owned, or oftentimes they're exporting all the wages to somewhere else to fund the government's needs and desires, instead of the actual people who are reaping all this grain are not getting any of it themselves. And so sin depraved capitalism produces the same evil that sin depraved socialism produces.
Yeah. Godly capitalism is fair, just, and liberal. It's not a true naked capitalism. It's when powerful people can just squash all competition and basically cheat. So that's where there's some government.
But there's some laws being broken when they do that.
Naked capitalism is like no law, have your own way versus being restrained.
But there are laws in place.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But they don't mind keeping those laws.
Right. Yeah, we had another conversation about that, just about how many of the times things that people see as environmentally destructive are very beneficial if used correctly. Like we were talking about with spraying. Like when you do it correctly, it can be a fantastic thing, right? And it's the abusive ones that just, I'm going to do whatever I want and who cares if it's blowing on my neighbor, right? It's, if I'm going to dump this in the river, who cares who's downstream, type of thing. We got time. 50. Okay. Well, our last topic is global warming / today's term, climate change. Climate change. Dave, I was thinking we need to update some of our statistics. Okay.
Yeah.
One of the interesting things I found, like, is there global warming, right? It says in a survey of 530 climatologists from 27 different countries, released in 2003, 82% of scientists agree with the statement. We can say for certain that global warming is a process already underway. Most climate scientists believe that the Earth has warmed a slight 0.8 degrees Celsius in the last century. And then, are humans responsible? So do you agree or disagree with that climate change is mostly the result of anthropogenic or man-made causes? So slightly more than half, 55.8% of climate scientists surveyed agreed, 14.2% were unsure, 30% disagreed. More scientists strongly disagree than strongly agree that climate change is mostly a result of anthropogenic causes. The survey clearly shows that the debate over why the climate is changing is still underway, with nearly half of climate scientists disagreeing with what is often claimed to be the consensus view. And this is just one person's observation from what I've seen research, is that when you have a question that you ask, and it's kind of a new question, right? Scientists and researchers don't particularly have a stake, right, in what their research findings are. They're more exploratory research.
Ideally.
So what I mean is that if you have ask a question, no other researchers have made any comment or done a study or whatever that has supported, or, you know, say there's a brand new drug, nobody knows if it's going to be good or bad.
There's no funding.
So, right? Maybe you're going to do some research to figure this out, right? So there's several things that will influence this kind of change in what the consensus is, right? So we talked about one, right? One's the funding, right? So research will always follow the funding, and wherever there's money, there'll be research that supports whoever has the money, right? So the soda industry does tons of research on the harmfulness of, like, the... or not necessarily soda, the sugar industry, on why harmful artificial sweeteners are, right? Mm-hmm. Yes. And the artificial sweeteners have tons of research that talk about how destructive sugar is,
uh-huh.
Right? So it's very, very true that the money will support. But then there's also the, I don't know what I call it, the scientific community.
The pressure.
Peer, right? Peer review. So most journals, most academic journals, if I'm going to write an article on some topic, so like mine's teaching math, right? And I do research. If my article needs to be approved to get published in a journal, it has to pass peer review, which means that other people in my field have to read it and say, this is academically acceptable, or they did good research here. Now, if that research contradicts their own findings or the findings of the community, it's very unlikely, in my opinion, that they're going to approve of it, because I'm viewing things in a way that's different from
the consensus,
which is viewed to be scientific.
Right.
Right? So it's very difficult to have scientific findings that counteract existing scientific findings. And in one sense, that's good, because they'll say, if you have a huge amount of evidence supporting the fact that gravity is a constant, right, it should take a large amount of evidence to reject that. And so the hard part is that you often have scientists that, instead of basing their findings on, right, instead of basing on data, right, their research becomes citing other people that also have the same findings, right? So I come up with a study, I do one study, and I have a hypothesis, and it's supported. And then somebody else does a similar study, and they get similar results, and we support each other, see? And then they do a similar study, and they support each other. And the fact that we all did these studies that were similar, come to the same results, now has created this community, and now that's what peer review is measured against. And so if you think differently or observe something differently, you're not likely to get published, especially if you don't have money backing that research. So I think there's kind of this, it was difficult for me kind of peeling back when I was doing my doctoral dissertation. Like, I would read something, okay, where did you get that? And there'd be citation. So, right, where did you get that citation? So, in the sense, after a while, you get back to the same loop of I cited him, and he cited them, and they cited me, and we cited each other. And usually there's a foundational, they're observing something happening, but they're using one another's conclusions to kind of support why that's happening, and what's going on there. And so I would say I bring that up because with global warming, right, when we started talking about, you know, man-made and stuff, as the ebb and flow goes, the more of community pressure is, the more difficult it is for any studies to be published that say anything different, if that makes sense. So when you read that research, it's hard for... And one thing I'm frustrated by and thankful for is that oftentimes people in the scientific community will say evidence suggests or things like that, but then when someone reads it and then they report on it, they say scientists have proven, right?
So it went from a suggestion to
right.
Fact.
Right, because the experts know that there's a lot that they don't know, right? I saw a funny quote the other day that said, the problem is that the experts have doubts and that the people that don't know are sure about everything.
Yeah. Right? So Dunning-Kruger, they call it Dunning-Kruger effect.
Okay. Yeah, it's hilarious, but sad at the same time.
Yes.
So we'll talk about that. And so when you think about, you know, what scientists are saying, you have to drill it down to each one is an individual human being, right? Is doing a very, very limited amount of science and based on their own biases and those things. And so to say scientists, you have to think about, well, which of these really did anything that was adding something that we can really base on, and how much of it is just coming to similar conclusions, starting from the same point, looking at data the same way. So we will talk about it more next time. I'll see if I can find some interesting, yeah. See if there's any differences.